school, I started a company to build on that technology, but not for virtual reality, but for things like drones and automated machinery. First and most fundamental mechanism is that whenever anyone uses the service and gets high accuracy location data from GeoNet, they are directly affecting the burn of tokens.
Mike Horton has an experience of more than 20 years in the navigation industry. He is recognized as a top 50 expert in sensor technology and is the founder of GeoNet. GeoNet is world's largest RTK network and enables a 100x improvement in position accuracy as compared to standalone GPS. Built using crypto incentives and DPIN principles and backed by best Web3 investors,
miners cost $700, and they're available worldwide through a network of about 13 or so distributors. You get them up, set them up on your rooftop. If you're the first into your hex and you set up a miner well, then you can lock a NFT, which will guarantee that as long as you're running that station in a high quality way, you can earn the top rewards rate. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the DY and the mapping projects as well.
If you were not building GeoNet, what else would you build?
Well, I'd definitely be working on geospatial and positioning technologies. This is my passion. Robotics and the use cases of these really motivate me to work on the core technology.
Hey, Mike, welcome to the Open Metaverse Show.
Good morning. Good to see you, Manny.
My pleasure. Mike, to kick things off, I would love for our audience to learn more about yourself. So if you can tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into crypto, that would be great.
Sounds good. So my background is electrical engineering and computer science. I went to UC Berkeley and studied in sort of robotics, and actually at the time worked on virtual reality. So built a head tracking system for tracking heads and hands in an immersive environment. Keep in mind, this was 1995 or something when I entered UC Berkeley. So it was way, way early. And so I learned a little bit about the technology cycles. But out of school, I started a company to build on that technology, but not for virtual reality, but for things like drones and automated machinery. So I've been working in the field of autonomous and robotics really my whole career, particularly around the field of positioning and what's called localization. So knowing where something is, where something's going. I built up a business in that space called Crossbow Technology, which was a very successful exit. Sold part of the business to an overseas company, a semiconductor company called Memsic, and sold part of the business to a large U.S. aerospace and defense company for sort of some of the drone applications. After that, got into some angel investing and then got back into the field of navigation about 4 or 5 years ago and started a company that's built up an incredible business and a new type of gyroscope used for, again, navigation. And then a couple of years back, started looking at how to solve some of the classic problems with GPS around accuracy and reliability and resiliency of GPS. And that's where GeoNet was born. And we first sort of looked at trying to do it in a Web2 way and realized that the cost to deploy stations in places like American Tower or public storage, trying to get stations out, would be, even if we could build a low-cost station like we've done with GeoNet, this sort of consumer-ready to set up at your house, trying to deploy it through traditional means would be billions and billions of dollars of capital investment to build out a network like what GeoNet's done. That led us to meet David Chen, who's the third co-founder and our blockchain guru. He's kind of an OG in the blockchain space, and he has helped us kind of replicate and leverage the model, I think, that really Helium set out there through the IoT type of network, and also avoid some of the mistakes they did and build out GeoNet using DeepN. And it's been an amazing ride. We've been able to take that and get it up to be the world's largest network in just 2 years.
Mike, you mentioned something about exit for our audience. Can you just tell us how big the exit was in terms of dollar amount?
So Crossbow was sold, my first company, and there was a $32 million exit to Moog Aerospace, and then an $18 million exit to the semiconductor company called Memsic. And so we sort of split the business along the lines. There was a kind of higher end product line that went to Moog Aerospace and a lower end product line that went to MEMSIC, which is a semiconductor company that builds actually IMU chips. So all told, it was about a $50 million exit, just under $50 million.
And Mike, just for our audience, I think before this podcast, I was kind of like Googling about you, found a Wikipedia page. So learned that you got like a couple of awards as well. You're regarded as one of the experts in sensors. Like there was a award in 2019. There was an award with MIT. Maybe you can also tell our audience a little bit about your awards. I think
I got a few awards over the times. Definitely well known in the sensor space. So going back to the founding team, so my personal technical expertise is really deeply around sensor fusion and what we kind of call the rover side. So the device that is figuring out where it is and how to navigate, sort of the vehicle side of the equation. And then other co-founder, Dr. Yudan Yi, he's a PhD in geodesy. He's started his career at Topcon, which is a classic high-end, high-precision location services business, very big Japanese company. And then he built out the world's largest network in China, or I shouldn't say the world's largest network, we're the world's largest network, but the biggest RTK network in China with a company called Qianxuan, which is a joint venture between Alibaba and a state-owned enterprise there. And then came back to the U.S. and I met him and started to work on building out a network that could serve the whole world. So a lot of deep expertise in the field that we're in. Between he and I, we know kind of a lot of people in the GPS satellite navigation world. And that's one of our advantages to the marketplace, is that we really know the professional community that builds the chips, that builds the software, that builds the products that use positioning in them as a core part.
Amazing. Mike, I think now we have established that you are a navigation expert, something at Animoca when we first spoke with you, it was very clear. I think for our audience, it will be great if you can explain what is GeoNet and how does the network function. And whilst you're explaining what is GeoNet, explain to our audience like you're explaining to a five-year-old.
Sure. We all know that our devices like to tell us where we are and that that's very useful and that we share a location and that we depend on location services for everything from Uber to Amazon delivering a package to our home to getting to the airport. And I think we've all learned to be very dependent on those location services. And those location services are primarily provided by satellites. And those satellites work pretty well, but they sometimes don't work so well. And we also feel that pain. GeoNet really solves for the case where they're not working very well. And it also enables those signals that come from the satellites to be much, much more accurate so that you can do things like robotics, you can do things like augmented reality, and you can have things like autonomous cars. And that's where GeoNet Network provides really a next generation location signal to all kinds of devices, from very high-end things down to consumer things.
So GeoNet is one of the largest RTK network in the world. Just for our audience, can you explain what does that mean?
Yeah, so RTK is the specific acronym that this technology that provides centimeter positioning accuracy is called. It stands for real-time kinematics. And why it's real-time is because simultaneously with when your device is receiving satellites from satellites, say your phone, the network is receiving those same signals through a network of terrestrial base stations. And that's where the mining aspect of GeoNet comes in, and the deepen aspect is setting up these terrestrial base stations. We now have over 8,000 of those registered on the network. I'm actually close to 9,000. And to put it in perspective, the largest prior network built was around 5,000 stations. So we're coming up on, you know, a second lap around the largest Web 2 implementations out there on the planet. We have those stations really everywhere it's legal to operate a GeoNet base station. We pretty much have a start, and certainly in the European Union. In Eastern Europe, we have really incredible coverage. And here in North America, we have very good coverage. Still a few gaps in some of the areas that are not so well populated, but we're closing those up. And we're starting to work on building coverage in Latin America, Africa, and Southeast Asia. So it's growing like crazy. About 150 to 200 new stations are added a week. And that's really the core. Having the terrestrial network coverage is what lets you enable these incredible high accuracy services.
So Mike, just to summarize it for our audience, you guys are building a deep end network where folks can put up a miner out there. Basically, the miner takes the data from satellite, makes it more accurate. And because of that accuracy, it enables different novel applications such as drones, autonomous vehicles, things like that. They can do interesting and novel stuff. Is that summary correct?
That's great. Yeah, that's a great summary. Thank you for simplifying it a bit.
Like one of the things with these deep in time network, economics becomes really important. So I think I would love to do a deep dive with you on some of the economics here. The first question is, how does the economic work? So for example, what is the cost of setting up this miner? Are there any variations in terms of setting up a miner?
Miners cost $700 and they're available worldwide through a network of about 13 or so distributors. You get them up, you set them up on your rooftop. If you're the first into your hex and you set up a miner well, then you can lock an NFT, which will guarantee that as long as you're running that station in a high quality way, you can earn the top rewards rate. The rewards rate today is for a well performing miner is 24 tokens a day, about 8,000 tokens per year. And so that, you can calculate out what the ROI is depending on what token price assumption you use. And we think that the stations are very reliable. You should plan on running that station for years and years and years to come. That's the supply side economics.
So, Mike, in terms of the hex, let's assume right now I'm in Pakistan. I set up a miner in some location in Karachi. So, since I'm the first one in that region to set up a miner, will my rewards be locked in? Or let's say if other people like start putting up miner, how does the reward get distributed? I would love to learn more about that, like how you guys are implementing that mechanism, because I think
One
it's
of the things that
interesting.
we saw and understood is we want to generate high quality supply. And high quality supply is not going to be generated if you have overcrowding in a hex. And then you're going to have, people fighting over a fixed amount of rewards for a hex, say, or you're going to have too many tokens being generated for the amount of coverage that's being generated. So what we did is a novel thing to use what we call a location NFT. So if you are the first miner in a hex to set up that station and get to a 98% overall, what we call reliability rate, recurring rewards rate, then you can lock an NFT, which will guarantee that you will be able to maintain the maximum rewards rate of the network in that hex for as long as you run that station in a high quality way. Now, if more miners come in, they can still earn, but they're going to share rewards with each other. So each hex has a maximum potential of twofold reward rates within that hex. So the first guy that gets the NFT is guaranteed the full rewards rate, so long as he's running his station. Other, say, three miners come into that hex because Karachi is a big city. A lot of people are interested in the project there. Three more people come into that hex, they're going to share rewards at 33, 33, 33. So instead of 24 tokens a day, they're going to be earning, say, 8 tokens a day if they're all equally good miners and they're equally set up at sort of in a very high quality way. So there is a first mover advantage, and there is what we're trying to do is get that coverage. We're trying to get an even, well-structured, geometrically sound network to provide the people who use a network high quality signal everywhere they are within, a city like Karachi.
So, Mike, in terms of DeepIn, one problem a lot of projects have is oversupply, and then the projects are cognizant about that. And I think you guys have like implementation of various mechanism to ensure there isn't oversupply. Like HEX NFT is like one way, but you guys also have halving and buyback and burn. So for our audience who kind of started with Helium and kind of came, there were issues with oversupply of tokens and things like that. Can you walk our audience through some of the mechanism you guys have implemented to ensure there isn't an oversupply and the bootstrapping of the marketplace is done efficiently?
Yeah, so I think the first and most fundamental mechanism is that whenever anyone uses the service and gets high accuracy location data from GeoNet, they are directly affecting the burn of tokens and buyback and burn of tokens. So effectively, any amount of money paid in fiat for the service will result in that same amount of money of GOD being burned, being bought. Being purchased off the open market through like the Uniswap API. So if $100 of GeoNet service is used, $100 of GOD token will be bought from the open market. And then 80% of those tokens will be sent to the burn address, and 20% are returned to the foundation's treasury. So the 80% that are sent to the burn are taken out of supply permanently. So we have a very strong deflationary tokenomics where tokens are being constantly burnt and sent to the burn address. And people worry, are we going to run out of tokens? And the answer to that is no, we're not going to run out of tokens because the market will continually to equilibrate, but it will provide a good, strong forcing function to, you know, keep the network stable. And then the second mechanism is, you know, as the network grows and it's growing very quickly, you do have to adjust the amount of tokens that are emitted. And we believe that this sort of Bitcoin model is the best. We think a halving with clear dates and clear communication of the halving schedule is the best for everybody to understand that. So that's the mechanism that we've implemented. And the emissions halves on a per miner basis, halves every year. We just passed through our second halving at the end of June. So now we'll be at the current rewards rate for basically almost another 4 year here.
Amazing. Mike, even on the protocol level, I think these two implementation, the way I kind of think about this is it makes the project a pure network play. So whatever growth of the network is, it kind of translates into the token price, into the way token accrues value. Another concept I think I've been thinking about a lot in terms of DeepIn is a concept I call threshold scale. Like, let's say at a given level, what is the number of nodes required? Or let's say have full coverage in US and Europe. And also you kind of start seeing a backup coverage and high density. But let's say if some nodes fail, there is that level of protection. So in your head, what is that threshold scale that you are targeting, and what is the target for next couple of years?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things to emphasize is that this problem of high precision location has never reached full scale. So all the Web2 companies that have tried and the governments that have tried to build out networks have never really reached a scale that gives full coverage and really can make the service a universal thing, which is a big part of the reason that you today on your phone don't have this type of, you know, capability, why it hasn't reached mass market. So it's incredible that we scaled the network to, you know, be the biggest network in the world, but we're not there yet in terms of getting that full mass market coverage capability. We think at 20,000 nodes, we'll definitely have it done for the vast majority, you know, what I'd call developed world and even developing world locations where there's a quick monetization strategy. Now, long term, when you just look at our hex size and how we've organized it to cover the entire land surface of the planet with stations, you know, we would need about 100,000 stations. And now there's a lot of areas that really economically will be a long, long time before it makes sense to, you know, need stations in the center of Greenland. But there is scientific use cases and climate research use cases for those stations. So we do have as a long-term goal for the project to reach 100,000 nodes. But it's a practical, like, how can we build this into a huge protocol that everyone in the planet is using for as part of their positioning solution? Then 20,000 is the number there. So we're just under halfway to getting to that magic 20,000 number.
Mike, earlier you mentioned that you guys have a buyback and burn mechanism. To my understanding, the revenues are coming from our Web2 customers. Can you tell me about your Web2 customers? And can you tell me how they're using Jonet on vertical by vertical basis?
Yeah, you bet. So yeah, we do primarily, you know, monetize through Web2 customers, actually really today exclusively through Web2 customers. I do think there's going to be some super cool Web3 usage coming up fairly soon, but today it's all Web2. We service a number of markets. We can kind of walk through those. So we can start off with agriculture. So agriculture has been a big traditional user of high precision location services for planting, harvesting, spraying, all the different operations that are done in the field. You can think about, you know, generally fields are organized in rows and those rows are spaced at way under a meter. So if you want to do any automated work on that, you need the, you know, inch level accuracy is really important and helpful. Super cool example customer who's now helping us, you know, promote the adoption of this technology to smaller farms is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And you'll see us, you'll see some news around the relationship that the USDA set up a node and is actively working with the system and showing it to smaller farmers. But we have a number of commercial customers in that space, Deep Sand, AliNav. Frankly, all of the three major tractor makers are using GeoNet in one way or another. So we're getting great adoption in agriculture. Another and super exciting market is automotive. Automotive is a huge market. There are a number of applications from just better car navigation to automated driving assisting systems. We really approach that market through semiconductor partners, people who make the GPS chip and kind of designing the GeoNet service at the forefront of that offering for high precision locations. So an example there is Quectel. We've had a great partnership. They're the world's largest IoT modem maker. So you can think of these cars that have a telematics link, right, that you're able to update the firmware in your car. Many, many, many of those vehicles are running the Quectel 4G or 5G module in them. And so we've embedded with Bechtel as a service provider for their offerings in the RTK space. Another example in that category is a Binaf, which is another player that's making what's called the T-Box. So the T-Box is in most vehicles in the U.S. are still on the T-Box technology. It's just a simple telematics box that's doing kind of the tracking and, you know, connectivity for the vehicle. P-Box stands for precision box, and those are in the Asian markets now enjoying very high adoption. So we're designed in and these things through companies, the OEMs in the space like Quectel and Binat and so forth. Another space I am personally super fired up about that we're selling services in is consumer and kind of commercial robotics. And I think that autonomous driving is great, but I think there's going to be just a ton of other robotic applications that are going to improve our life. I use the analogy today. Think about the average person has how many iPhone or Android devices. It's not one. It's like 2, 3, 4, depending on the person. You know, they got their phone, they got their pad, they may have a watch. They have this whole ecosystem of devices. I think over the next 5, 10 years, you're going to have that same ecosystem of devices that are robots helping you do things. And that is, of all the markets, for me personally, one I'm just really fired up about. I think these outdoor robots, such as the robotic mowers, are going to have a huge impact. They're going to make the life better for people. They're quiet, they're green, they're efficient. And, you know, GeoNet's super proud to have already multiple partners in the robotic mowing space. Sensori Robotics is one that we published a video with. We have Verde.ai that's coming out with a consumer residential, you know, robot that's only like $1,300. It'll be the first consumer-facing robot to use an RTK network so that you don't have to set up a bunch of equipment at your home to run this thing. You can just turn it on, map, and mow. Really exciting space, really big. I don't know if people realize it. Last year, 18 million Roombas shipped. So their indoor robotic vacuum market, $7.5 billion, 18 million consumer smart robots shipped. That's quite a few. But I think as you get to these higher value, you know, that things like landscaping, it's a much more money in that. For agricultural robotics, it's really going to drive much bigger markets. And so I think over the next few years, that's going to be just a huge market. And a service like GeoNet is really front and center to enabling those experiences. Having the coverage and the cost of precision location is just elemental to being able to deliver those types of robotic solutions.
Mike, maybe also tell our audience a little bit about on the drone side.
Drones are, you know, drones is another big category. We have multiple partnerships in the drone space. We're working with Rock Robotic. We're working with Whisper. We're working with a number of different drone manufacturers and drone suppliers that supply services for photogrammetry, for mapping, for drone delivery, for drone in a box. So a drone in a box is where the drone kind of can return to the drone, to the box, recharge, and take off again. Precision location is important to all of those. To put it in perspective, any enterprise-grade DJI drone you buy, you can connect to DJI in about 5 seconds. It is really, really easy. You go to a settings page on your DJI controller, you put in the GeoNet account information that you've got, and you're up and running, and now your drone will hover in like a golf ball size pattern, regardless of the wind or conditions. So very powerful. Drones are really starting to build out a lot of enterprise use cases, and I think that super exciting. We will actually be at the commercial UAS show here in 2 weeks in Las Vegas. So we have a exhibition there, and we will have two new customer announcements in the drone infrastructure space.
So Mike, there's a lot to unpack here. So just to give a TLDR for our audience, basically in US we have our traditional GPS. Because of weather, because of terrestrial friction, you might not have the best signal, and because of that you might not have precision with some of these applications that require maybe not sizes, 2 centimeter or 10 centimeter. And because of the RTK technology that you guys have been able to proliferate, these application gets unlocked. For example, automated lawn mowing, they can use the data from your devices to kind of do things in an automated way. Is that a good summary?
Right. I mean, essentially, we provide a signal that's about 100 times more accurate than GPS that allows for automation of things, whether that's landing, whether that's for drones, whether that's driving within a lane accurately, any place you would need accuracy and reliability in order to navigate the world, GeoNet can provide that.
And Mike, what are some of the other applications apart from the ones you mentioned that you are excited about on a going forward basis?
Well, I think, yeah, all the applications I've mentioned so far, those are the ones that we're generating revenue today from. Our ARR has passed over $1 million, and we're still very much in kind of early rollout with customers. And many of the things that we've signed and announced in terms of customers are just at the very beginning, the revenue generation. But I think beyond those types of more traditional robotics applications, there's mobile phones and there's gaming and there's just totally brand new use cases that have never been done before around consumer. And those are super exciting. I think the mobility we have recently announced, and it's part of the network's reason why we're also starting to support GOD on Solana, which we think is super exciting, is the mobile phone ecosystem. And the mobile phone ecosystem doesn't use these types of corrections today. They do use some, we do provide data services to some people who provide what's called global ephemeris data products to phones. That's part of how your phone is able to get its basic location quickly. And that's a revenue generator for us. But in terms of high precision location, that's not there yet. We're building an SDK out. We've been pushing this through the GeoNet governance process to support that mobile ecosystem with some additional, you know, tokens that can be made to help stimulate that mobile app ecosystem. That's going to, you know, have a big impact on basic car navigation, day-to-day usage, B2B apps within that, you know, things like mobility, rideshare, I think can all take advantage of this technology. But really super exciting is gaming. You know, augmented reality relies on the precise overlay of the digital world and the physical world to meld into one. And so if you trying to do shared augmented reality and I'm in position A and the next person that sees it is in position, you know, A plus 3 meters to the left or the right, it's not going to work right. The digital and the physical aren't going to align right. So that's an area that we think is poised for big growth, but it's not there today. We're enabling it. You know, GeoNet is a service that can enable that. And we're building out partnerships and technology. I think first technology and then, you know, rollout of this mobile app ecosystem that's ongoing. We have a lot of exciting things in the back half of this year in that space. And then in the beginning, we're going to really launch the SDK that would allow anyone to build the service into an app at CES in 2025.
Mike, it's pretty clear now. You have a symmetric knowledge in terms of the navigation industry and have forged loads of relationship. And then that kind of gives you edge and the deep insight. I will be keen to learn more about your Web3 partnership. I think you alluded earlier that you're working on some of those Web3 partnership. We can touch upon and maybe you can guide us on how you guys are integrating your technology with some of the other Web3 deepened players and other partners.
Yeah, so in the Web3 space, there are an awful lot of projects in deepened and even outside of deepened that do depend on trusted location. Let's start there. And, you know, you can think of even some of the attempts and sort of and successes really in mobile gaming within Web3. They have struggled a lot with fraud and they've struggled a lot with people faking their location and doing stuff like that. So one of the data products that GeoNet can provide is a sort of anti-spoofing technology. And that's because we have this huge network of trusted miners that are out there. Those devices have a crypto chip in there. They're being able to see the satellite signals first for a given region. So when a device, you know, comes up with a position, we're able to sort of at the low level of the signals within that device validate that those signals are authentic and real. And then there are additional, you know, Web3 projects and mapping that do need the high accuracy as well. And those mapping projects can be doing it from the ground or they can be doing it from the air. I think there's Web3 projects that are really exciting in both of those categories. And there, they really do need the high precision, the data products that they're trying to produce and a map that is true and accurate This is something that's very important. If you look at the way traditional mapping is done, I mean, that's often called survey. There's a whole industry around that. There's a huge show every year called InterGeo in Germany that deals with it. There's a show in the U.S. called Esri, and both of those are communities that Jim that's active in the Web2 side. But their struggle, mapping projects struggle with data collection. So the Web3 DeepN model for mapping is very exciting. And we're happy to be supporting a number of protocols that are working to develop solutions that can build out, permissionless, censorship-resistant mapping technologies. Very, very important. So long-term, mapping is a really hard problem. So these are long-term plays, but a GeoNet can play an important role to help build those out.
So Mike, let's shift gears a little bit. We have discussed about different facets with regards to GeoNet. Some of the folks, this might sound theoretical, but I know GeoNet lately has been printing great numbers in terms of growth. So maybe you can walk us through some of the metrics, whether it's revenue, miners deployed, customer in the pipeline, and things like that. Maybe perhaps you can share your screen on the dash.
There we go. So we keep a Dune dashboard updated with on-chain data. And I think you can kind of get a quick glimpse of the number of miners that have been registered on the network. Is it 8,596, covering 3,771 cities in 136 countries. So an awful lot of places you can use the service today. And that's what the Web2 customers love the most, is they know that they can turn on and get their device, their chip, their robot, whatever it is, can turn on and get precise location in so many places.
These miners are already out there. Maybe you can also tell us a little bit about the miners that are in the pipeline that were sold, but will eventually be deployed in coming days.
Yeah, so I think we're catching up, but we've had been running on a little bit behind on the network. In terms of our 13 distributors, have all been kind of running a bit behind on getting hardware out because it's just been such a fast growth year for us. But we're catching up, so there's still a good number in the pipeline to be installed, and we're targeting 10,000 by early 2025. I think that's a realistic curve with the supply chain and everything like that. But yeah, you can see the network growth here on the chart, and then you can see the amount of token burn in terms of usage of the network, and what that translates into the dollars. And you can also see it here on a monthly basis of the token burn, and what that translates to in terms of revenue usage. And then finally, you can see the token emissions, and you can clearly see the halving at the end of June 2023, and then the halving again at the end of June 2024. So the Dune dashboard is kind of a great way to see kind of the tokenomics and how the network is working at a glance.
And just for our audience, on an annualized basis, how much revenue are you guys generating?
So just over $1 million right now. Excited that we think that we're at the beginning of that curve. You never know. I mean, the real world, you can't predict exactly when certain things are going to hit. There's some things that have come in earlier than we thought, and some things that are taking a little bit longer than we would think. So you have this sort of give and take, push and pull. But overall, very, very pleased with how the network is developing. And we do see a lot of categories that we're going to be able to knock down. I also think with any network effect business, you have to build up supply to a certain degree to build up the demand, then you build up the demand, then you build up some more supply. And I think that cycle, people forget that took Uber, it took Airbnb, it took any of these two-sided marketplaces a while to get through. And we want to emphasize, look, DeepN is physical infrastructure. We are building real unlock with the infrastructure. We are enabling real new services that can be used for decades to come. But it does take a little bit of time and a little bit of patience to build up an infrastructure network. So we're working through that, but really pleased to see the adoption that we've had, and think that the best is yet to come for sure.
Mike, I also want to cover competitive landscape just so I can learn, and maybe our audience can also learn. Do you think someone like American Tower can replicate this network?
Yeah, that's probably not a realistic one. I think that American Tower is really a real estate company, and they don't have the expertise to build and manage these highly technical networks. There's a lot that goes beyond in the scenes to make all this work in the protocol. Every station has to be continually 24/7 monitored, because if it does move or start to not perform, we got to pull it out of the network really instantly. Feeding somebody a bad location and many of these applications could even potentially result in safety consequences. So there's a lot of technical expertise to run a network like this, and I don't think that that's something that American Tower has. And you got to build all that into the protocol, and because it has to scale, these things have to be automated. When a station is put up, it has to automatically get its precise coordinate. So the stations, go through a process with some software tools. We use InRCam from the Government of Canada, and we're building out our own as well to do a lot of the stuff. It's just quite complex, quite complex.
And Mike, do you reckon there are other competing technology out there, or maybe in the future, that can also enhance precise location? And if so, do you kind of see them as a threat?
We see them as an opportunity, and there are a couple I would like to highlight that we're working towards that will be very complementary. And one is low Earth orbit satellites. So people hear about, Starlink. There are 5,000 plus Starlink satellites out in the sky. To put that in perspective, there are about 55 PNT satellites, GNSS satellites. So between PS, GLONASS, Galileo, and Beta satellite constellations, all of which GEONET tracks and uses, there's about 50, 55 satellites in the sky, something like that you can see at any one time. This just depends on your location in the world. If you're in Asia, you're going to see more than you see if you're in the West. Compare that to Starlink with 5,000 plus satellites in the sky. So the low Earth orbit satellite space is one that is complementary, can help with things like the signal strength and penetrating the signal into more spaces. And we're really fired up about that. We have some things already going on, commercial partnership there that we can't talk about yet, but we're very excited about low Earth orbit satellites as a complementary technology, and the one that will need GeoNet to really realize its full potential for positioning. Another technology that's complementary on the indoor side is ultra wideband, and that's something that we also plan to integrate over time. So there are other technologies, and we see them as complementary. And part of our goal is to build out really a network that can just deliver high accuracy reliably to any device that wants to get it.
And Mike, can you foresee with technologies like Starlight, instead of having 100,000 minor nodes to get coverage, those technology can reduce that number to maybe 60,000, 70,000? Is that something that can happen?
In the case of Starlink and low Earth orbit satellites, it's kind of actually not the case. They're going to need the dense network as much as anyone. The errors that come into the network come through variable signal delays in the ionosphere and troposphere. And those variable signal delays are caused by the solar wind. And so that's present whether you're a low Earth orbit satellite or whether you're a geostationary satellite in deep space, like some of the GPS satellites. Actually, the low Earth orbit satellites, they buzz over the sky really fast. So they're actually cutting across the space weather faster than a traditional PNT satellite. So there's research published by University of Colorado Boulder, Dr. Jaden Morton, who's considered probably the top expert in space weather in the United States. She's published research showing that for using low Earth orbit satellites for PNT for positioning, which is something that isn't really there yet, but it's coming, and we're excited about it. You're going to need the terrestrial network as much as ever, because these ionic scintillation is even more of a factor. You have deeper fades and more effects for them than you would, say, satellite in deeper space. So I think, in general, to aggregate this data, to get it proper and to deliver accuracy, you're always going to need a network like GeoNet to help make that happen.
Mike, so who would you say are your competitor in this space?
Yeah, so I think in the biggest competitors are the Web2 entities that have been working on this, and to some degree, we don't really think of them as competitors. We think of them as opportunities to work with, but some of the governments have set up stations. The Web2 competitors and the governments, they've built out networks. Government networks tend to be very localized and regional. So like in the United States, there's state networks. So Georgia will have a network, Ohio will have a network. These networks have not been keeping up with the pace of change of all the new satellites and signals that are coming down. And Often they don't make any sort of SLA guarantees at all. So they're really there for government workers and survey and water management and these types of things to be able to use the signal. So we're providing a more commercially scalable product line, and as well as in some areas, we've actually seen government networks switch over to using GeoNet. I give an example of Sri Lanka is now a GeoNet country, had been maintaining a network, and they decided that the value proposition that we provide is really great. And so they're jumping on. I think we're going to see more of that, the state and local level, where they want a denser network and they want better accuracy, but trying to maintain that themselves is very expensive for the budget. We think that we can work into those models. Then on the Web2 company side, you know, you have a couple of very large public companies that have been working to build out networks over the last 20 years. Their services are great, but they tend to be pretty expensive. They also tend to be quite deeply integrated with their specific workflows. So one of the cool things about GeoNet is being an open and permissionless network. Anybody can really use it and take advantage of it, including those companies. So we do see some of the traditional service providers now, you know, integrating what we call wholesale data into their model. So using GeoNet to cover areas where maybe they don't have stations. Not many folks have stations in Eastern Europe, for example. We have great networks there. Asia, you know, then this is one of the motivations for us is to continue to build out that global coverage. And we're working hard to figure out how to scale deep in.
And Mike, that cost advantage that you just alluded to, do you think it primarily comes because of the fact that there's a permissionless network that anybody can say set up these miners and that increases the density?
Yes, I think that's right. And the overhead of trying to build out centralized infrastructure is phenomenal. I think anyone who's tried to build centralized infrastructure understands that the overhead associated with doing it, it's really hard to describe just how expensive and how time consuming it is. And so in that sense, people who are, quote, competitors really kind of like what we're doing because they're building those networks out, you know, for primarily to enable services for their customer. And if they can do that more cheaply, they'll just switch over. And then, you know, they won't be necessarily announcing, hey, we're using GeoNet, but they will be ingesting GeoNet data as part of their offering. And you know, that's just kind of how these decentralized technologies work. I mean, think about the internet. We're all using the internet in different ways. You don't raise your hand up and say, hey, I'm using, you know, XYZ's DNS server, but you are. And that's what our goal is to build this precise location service out as a fundamental utility that's available and delivered over the internet that has to be paid for in some way. And that's what blockchain enables. It enables that economic cycle to be created in a decentralized way that can be sustainable.
So Mike, what does the roadmap for GeoNet looks like in terms of upgrades or new product launches in the near future?
Yeah, I think the big focus for us right now, we kind of alluded to earlier, is to get this mobile, obviously to ramp, you know, customers on the network, but to get this mobile ecosystem built will be a big step function. As part of that, we're doing the token upgrade. So we'll have the token available on the Solana network. So much activity going there. I think the big hand, you know, high five to the Solana Foundation for all the work they do, and especially the Saga mobile team. I think that, you know, it's early. That's incredibly ambitious and hard project. But think about how draconian the App Store ecosystem is on Android and iOS. You know, just want to set up and put out an app. You've got to do all this stuff that's completely centralized, completely antithetical to what the internet is. You know, show your corporate paperwork, take phone calls, all this stuff just to put an app. Imagine if you had to do that to open a website, how broken the world would be. If every time somebody wanted to create a website, they needed to call up a central authority and apply, you know, for a permission to set up a website. Well, that's what it is to do an app on an app store. That's the process. So, you know, I just fundamentally am super behind what Solana is trying to do, the Saga phone, to build a dApp oriented, you know, ecosystem on mobile. I think it will take time. It will be very hard, but it could really solve a very broken ecosystem in the mobile app ecosystem today.
And to be fair, they have also motivated other ecosystems to launch their phones as well. I know Movement ecosystem is launching their phone. Dawn is also building their phone. So super. They have kind of, yeah.
It's really hard to predict, you know, how it's going to break out, but Man, it would sure benefit the world if we could break out of the mold that we are right now with the mobile app ecosystem. It's not super cool.
Mike, for the final segment of the podcast, it's a rapid fire round, so we'll keep it light, we'll keep it fun. So first question, if you were not building JioNet, what else would you build?
Well, I'd definitely be working on geospatial and positioning technologies. This is my passion. Robotics and the use cases of these really motivate me to work on the core technology.
So Mike, in terms of Web3, what are some of your favorite deepin project out there?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the DeFi and the mapping projects as well. So you've got, obviously the OG for the DY is Helium, ups and downs in every project, but very exciting. It's very exciting to see all the other DY projects that are out there working on it. Very excited about mapping protocols, again, Hive Mapper, but there's a bunch more coming up as well. Drone-based ones, pedestrian-based projects in the mapping space. I think mapping is a very hard problem. It's also pretty heavily censored. I don't think people understand how much kind of control and regulation there is around mapping. And while it's certainly important in the near term to comply with that, if we build as a community technologies that do put map data on the blockchain. So I'm thinking beyond just the data collection aspect, but actually the actual data itself being validated through a blockchain process. I think that could really make an improvement to the world.
Mike, what are some of your favorite blockchain applications?
Well, I mean, I think BTC, just start off with the original one. I think, gosh, I mean, if you haven't felt inflation in the last year, you've been living in a hole, right? I mean, I'm with some of the others in the on, I see on X, like I'm giving up Starbucks because, or at least I'm trying to, just because it's just getting ridiculous. So I think let's just start there. I think BTC is an, Bitcoin is an incredible, incredible innovation. I think the best is yet to come there for sure. And then Ethereum, and all the smart contracts. I love DeFi. I think DeFi is way underrated in its utility. I get kind of mad when I hear all investors tell us, oh, you gotta do CEX, the CEX. I'm like, well, DeFi works and it's much more elegant. So let's use it, let's promote it. And we're building it into the fundamental way that our buyback and burn mechanisms work. That needs to be decentralized. And that's important from a whole bunch of different angles, why it's super important that that mechanism is decentralized. And DeFi is the way to make that happen. So DeFi is an amazing thing. I look forward to more success in social and gaming. I think both of those are also areas that are super kind of broken in a certain way. I mean, why are content makers so beholden to Google and Facebook in order to monetize? And that has really perverse incentives around it, affect us as a society, and I think lead to some of the societal problems that we have. And if that wasn't there, if people could really directly use, blockchain to monetize and do that at scale, that would make the world such a better place.
Finally, Mike, a question I should have asked you but didn't.
A question you should have asked me that you didn't? Boy, Matty, you're thorough. So there are not too many out there. I think maybe one question is, how hard is it to get started? And this is a very sounds very technical and hard. It's actually really super easy to get started. And if you do have a good location where you have rooftop access and you have stable internet, I would really encourage people to look into setting up a GeoNet node. It's still early days, and it's something that we do want to see these nodes get out there and be stable and operate for a long, long time to come. So it's not hard, and it's really not hard to get involved.
And for our audience, we'll drop the links below in terms of JioNet website and some of the things we spoke about. Thank you, Mike, so much for joining us. I learned a lot, and it was good fun.
Thank you, Maddie, for having me. Look forward to catching up with you at Token 2049.
This is your host, Mehdi Farooq, signing off. See you next time. Thanks.
This podcast is for information purposes only and should not be considered as financial advice. Any opinions provided in this podcast reflect the views of the speakers only.